Our next speaker is Thomas DiLorenzo. Tom is professor of economics in the Selinger School of Business and Management at Loyola College in Maryland. He was also a Garvey Fellow, a program that the Institute runs for graduate students and junior faculty members. He holds a PhD in economics from Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, and he has taught at George Mason University, Washington University, State University of New York at Buffalo, and the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. In addition to The Real Lincoln, his other books include Underground Government, Destroying Democracy, Official Lies, and Public Health Profiteering. Professor DiLorenzo has published over 70 articles in various scholarly journals, especially in the field of economics, and he is widely published in popular publications such as the Wall Street Journal and others. I'm very pleased to introduce Tom DiLorenzo.
Thank you, David. I hope I'm half as bright as Harry when I'm his age. He's got 3 or 4 years on me, but I hope when I'm his age, I'm still standing up here giving very articulate and brilliant speeches like he does. And I certainly agree with him on Lincoln, on when cleverness and profundity. It's kind of pathetic that in my lifetime, I think of the best politician as a politician is Bill Clinton. I despise Bill Clinton, but as a politician, he's the best. And to compare, and when I think back of Abraham Lincoln, brilliant man, cleverness, profundity. Is right. You read Lincoln's speeches, then read Bill Clinton's speeches, and it's just horrible. But that's what we live with today. I'm going to tell a slightly different story about Lincoln, and I call him in my book the political son of Alexander Hamilton, because for most of his career prior to becoming president, he was a Whig, and he was an ardent follower, ardent promoter of the Whig economic agenda. And from the time of the founding of the Republic, and certainly until the war, there was the big debate between the Jeffersonians and Hamiltonians. Hamilton wanted a much more highly centralized state. For what? Primarily for economic planning. He was a protectionist. He wanted a high tariff. He wanted a central bank and so-called internal improvements, government-subsidized road building, canal building, and so forth. And Lincoln, when he became active in politics in 1832, became a Whig. And here's what he said. He said, when he first announced for office in the state legislature, "I presume you all know who I am. I'm humble Abraham Lincoln. I've been solicited by many friends to become a candidate for the legislature. My politics are short and sweet like the old woman's dance. I'm in favor of a national bank, in favor of the internal improvement system, and a high protective tariff," end quote. And that's pretty much, he diligently pursued that agenda for some 25 years. In 1859, he announced, quote, "I was always a Whig in politics." When he eulogized Henry Clay in 1852, he said Clay was the great parent of Whig principles. "During my whole political life, I have loved and revered Henry Clay as a teacher and a leader." And there's a relatively new book out called The History of the Whig Party by Michael Holt at the University of Virginia. And he says of Lincoln, he says, quote, "Few people in the Whig Party were so committed to its economic agenda as Lincoln," end quote. Robert Johansen says the same thing in his book, Lincoln, the South, and Slavery. And he also says that when the Whig Party imploded in the 1850s and Lincoln became a Republican, Johansen says, Lincoln had labored for 25 years in behalf of Henry Clay's American system, and he was not prepared to give up that investment. And so he assured the voters in Illinois that there weren't that many differences between the Whig and Republican parties. During the 1840 and 1848 presidential elections, Lincoln made many stump speeches in favor of the Whig candidates promoting the economic agenda. He had a big hand in the state of Illinois, internal improvements disaster in 1837. He was an influential member of the legislature, and the Whigs got through a $10 million appropriation for road building, canal building, and so forth. And William Herndon claimed that no one had more of a hand in this than Lincoln did. And what happened with this program was described by William Herndon in Life of Lincoln. He said, "The gigantic and stupendous operations of the scheme dazzled the eyes of nearly everybody. but in the end it rolled up a debt so enormous as to impede the otherwise marvelous progress of Illinois. The internal improvement system, the adoption of which Lincoln had played such a prominent part, had collapsed, with the result that Illinois was left with an enormous debt and an empty treasury. It was so bad that the Illinois Constitution was amended to prohibit the use of taxpayer dollars for private corporations of any sort. And also during this period, prior to the war, almost every state experimented with government corporate welfare, as I call it, for transportation. And it was such a debacle everywhere that by the time the war broke out, only Massachusetts permitted state funding in any way of these things. It was a horrible disaster everywhere. Lincoln was a protectionist his whole career, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. He and a lot of the other Whigs were devotees of Henry C. Carey, a publicist for the Pennsylvania steel industry, who once bragged that he only spent 3 days studying economics, but he could nevertheless debunk Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. And in some of his speeches, Lincoln just said what Henry Carey was Chicago Cubs fans out there. He used the argument that transportation costs what he called useless labor, so that if someone were to ship something from England to the United States, it's useless labor and we shouldn't abide by that. In one speech, he said that if it were up to him, the only things that would be allowed into the country as imports were things we did not make here. If we did not grow coffee here, that's okay, bring the coffee in. But if we made steel here, no steel, don't bring steel in. So he was an ardent protectionist his whole career. He once said that his aspiration in his early days was to be the DeWitt Clinton of Illinois. And DeWitt Clinton was the governor of New York who got the Erie Canal passed and is credited with introducing the spoils system to America. This was a big debate in the early part of the 19th century, the internal improvements debate. Thomas Jefferson's Secretary of the Treasury, Albert Gallatin, wrote up a huge central plan. It reminds me almost of sort of a Soviet central plan when you look at it, to build roads and canals all over the place. Jefferson said, you can't do that unless you amend the Constitution. James Madison, the very last thing he did as president was to veto an internal improvements bill because he said he could see nowhere in the Constitution where there was a right to spend tax dollars on a private corporation. James Monroe did the same thing, as did Andrew Jackson. On the other side were Hamilton, John Quincy Adams. John Quincy Adams, after he left the office, in a letter said that one of the deepest regrets he had was not being successful in putting an internal improvements program in. And he blamed what he called Jefferson's blighted breath, and he blamed it on the sable genius of the South, as he said, Calhoun. And then, of course, Lincoln picked up this mantle after Henry Clay, the mantle of what I call corporate welfare. Now, this system was called the American system. Henry Clay called this combination of economic policies the American system. And economists, though, call it mercantilism. It was sort of the old system from Europe, or a close connection between government and business, where the government would dispense favors to special friends in business in return for their political support, protectionist tariffs, corporate welfare, inflationism through central banking. In fact, you can argue that many of the people who came to America fled that corrupt high tax system. Edgar Lee Masters, not one of Harry's favorite authors, I'm sure, had a description of Henry Clay's economic system that I think he has it on the money, and the Clay-Lincoln system. He said, Henry Clay was a champion of that political system which doles favors to the strong in order to win and to keep their adherence to the government. His system offered shelter to devious schemes and corrupt enterprises. He was the beloved son of Alexander Hamilton, with his corrupt funding schemes and superstitions concerning the advantage of a public debt and a people taxed to make profits for enterprises that cannot stand alone. His example and his doctrines led to the creation of a party that had no platform to announce, the Whig Party, because its principles were plunder and nothing else. And I think that's pretty accurate. It was a special interest program. Now, the importance of the tariff. As I said, Lincoln, among the things his whole career they did was he was an advocate of protectionism. And there's a very important article to this issue by Reinhard Luthen in the American Historical Review, July 1944, that gives a good explanation of the importance of the tariff to Lincoln's political career. And it starts out by noting how in the election, Pennsylvania had the second highest number of electoral votes, and its issue was a protectionist tariff. And the Pennsylvania Republican Party made it known that anyone who wins Pennsylvania must sign on to a protective tariff. They're in the catbird seat. They had the power. Joseph Medill, the M-E-D-I-L-L, the editor of the Chicago Press and Tribune, a very influential paper, began promoting favorite son Abraham Lincoln for the presidency. And the way he did it was he began writing editorials saying things like this. He said, quote, "Lincoln was an old clay wig. He's right on the tariff, and he's exactly right on all other issues. Is there any man who could suit Pennsylvania better?" And so he's promoting him. Lincoln started soliciting the nomination. There is a relative by marriage of Lincoln's named Dr. Edward Wallace in Pennsylvania, and he was a Republican. And he wrote a letter to his brother, who passed it on to Lincoln, inquiring as of what are Lincoln's views on the tariff. And Lincoln wrote back on October 11, 1859. He said, "My dear sir, your brother, Dr. William S. Wallace, showed me a letter of yours in which you kindly mention my name, inquire for my tariff views, and suggest the propriety of my writing a letter upon the subject. I was an old Henry Clay tariff wig. In old times, I made more speeches on that subject than any other. I have not since changed my views." End quote. So Lincoln is establishing his bona fides as a protectionist here. And at the Republican Convention of 1860, Luthen writes about a firsthand account of what happened when the tariff plank was adopted. He said this, quote, "The Pennsylvania and New Jersey delegations were terrific in their applause over the tariff resolution, and their hilarity was contagious, finally pervading the whole vast auditorium. It was a big deal. Pennsylvania went for Lincoln. They voted for Lincoln, and he won Pennsylvania. And by winning Pennsylvania, that certainly was a huge help in him, in his winning the election. And then when he went back to Springfield, there was a Republican Party rally for him, and they had a big float that had, according to Luther, he says, several yards of jeans cloth from which a garment was fashioned for Lincoln, and the wagon bore the significant motto, quote, "Protection to home industry," end quote. So this was a big issue. I'm not saying slavery was not also a big issue. It certainly was. I don't argue that in my book. But economics was also important. Now look at the moral tariff was passed by the House of Representatives in the 1859-1860 session. And then the Senate passed it on May 2nd, 1861, 2 days before Lincoln was inaugurated. President Buchanan signed it into law. And so Lincoln didn't really have directly anything to do with it, although Luthen points out how he did have a lot to do with it by working behind the scenes on all the political maneuvering, and Lincoln was certainly a master politician. And so here you have Frank Taussig, the great tariff historian, in his book Tariff History of the United States, saying that as of 1857, the average tariff rate was about 15%, 1-5. Southerners had been complaining since the Tariff of Abominations in 1828 that they were being plundered by the tariff. They were import dependent. Taussig says that they were paying as much as 80% of all the tariff in various years, sometimes less than that, but he mentions that figure. The Republican Party orchestrates the moral tariff. That was their baby. And they proposed essentially tripling the rate. The rate would immediately go up to 37.5%. But then it would greatly expand the list of items that were covered, so roughly a tripling of the tariff tax. And then right after that, the rate went up to 47%. And so here's what's happening. The Southerners have been complaining for decades that they're being plundered by the tariff. They're paying most of it, and most of the money is being spent in the North. The Republicans come in and say, we're going to triple that. Lincoln is expected to enforce it. He makes his first inaugural address on March 4th, and he says this, quote, "The power confided in me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government, and to collect the duties and imposts. But beyond what may be necessary for these objects, there will be no invasion, no using force against or among the people anywhere," end quote. So the way I read that, he says, as long as you collect this triple tariff rate, there will be no invasion. But if you do what the South Carolinians did to Andrew Jackson and nullify it, that is, say we're not going to collect it, there will be an invasion. He promised an invasion over the tariff. After he was elected, Senator John Sherman was quoted in David Donald's book, Lincoln Reconsidered, of why Senator John Sherman thought Lincoln was elected. And he said this. Senator John Sherman is better known for being the author of the Sherman Antitrust Act. He was the brother of General William Tecumseh Sherman, influential member of the Senate during the war and for 30-some years after. Here's what he said. Those who've elected Mr. Lincoln expect him to secure to free labor its just right to the territories, to protect by wise revenue laws the labor of our people, to secure the public lands to actual settlers, to develop the internal resources of the country by opening new means of communication between the Atlantic and the Pacific, end quote. David Donald, in his book, says, let me translate this from the politician's idiom into plain English. And here's and how David Donald translates that is this. This is David Donald, the Pulitzer Prize-winning Lincoln biographer. And it's a great book to recommend it to everybody, that David should be selling it here. Lincoln and the Republicans intended to enact a high protective tariff that mothered monopoly, to pass a homestead law that invited speculators to loot the public domain, and to subsidize a transcontinental railroad that afforded infinite opportunities for jobbery, end quote. And of course, all that happened. Yeah, David Donald left out the first line, opposition to the extension of slavery into the territories. And of course, one of the reasons Lincoln and the Republicans gave for their opposition to the extension of slavery is they wanted to preserve the new territories for white labor. They were very clear on that. They said they wanted the political support of white laborers who did not want competition from slave labor. Yes, he made many eloquent statements in favor of natural rights, but that was also part of the reason they gave for opposition to this. Now, how is this to be achieved? How is this to be achieved? Not with secession, that's for sure. At the time, there's a big two-volume set of books called Northern Editorials on Secession by Howard Cecil Perkins. And he writes about how a lot of citizens and a lot of editorial writers in the North, he claims the majority of editorial writers in the North were in favor of peaceful secession. And I'll give you one or two examples. The Bangor Daily Noon Union on November 13, 1860 said this, the Union depends for its continuance on the free consent and will of the sovereign people of each state, and when that consent and will is withdrawn on either part, their union is gone. A state coerced to remain in the Union is a subject province and can never be a co-equal member of the American Union. And he quotes there are numerous newspapers that say those things in the North. Now, where did they get this idea of state sovereignty? Well, it might have been Thomas Jefferson in 1816 said this, if any state in the Union will declare that it prefers a separation to a continuance in Union, I have no hesitation in saying, let us separate. John Quincy Adams in 1839 in the Jubilee of the Constitution addressed secession. And he said, if it would ever happen, he said then, quote, then will be the time for reverting to the precedents which occurred at the formation and adoption of the Constitution to form again a more perfect union by dissolving that which could no longer bind and to leave the separated parts to be reunited by the law of political gravitation to the center, end quote. And so he wasn't in favor of forceful military action against it. Tocqueville said, Democracy in America, the Arlington House, 1945 version, page 381, the Union was formed by the voluntary agreement of the states, and in uniting together they have not forfeited their nationality, nor have they been reduced to the condition of one and the same people. If one of the states chooses to withdraw from the compact, it would be difficult to disprove its right of doing so, and the federal government would have no means of maintaining its claim directly, either by force or right. And so other relevant facts that I think are relevant, Harry argues with these, but each colony did declare sovereignty from Great Britain on its own. After the Revolution, the Treaty of Paris, each state was individually recognized as sovereign by the British government. The Articles of Confederation said, quote, each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence. States then seceded from the Articles and dropped the perpetual union language in the Constitution. Virginia's ratifying convention said, quote, the powers granted under the Constitution, being derived from the people of the United States, may be resumed by them whensoever the same shall be perverted to their injury or oppression, end quote. And then they asserted this right for all other states. In Federalist 39, Madison said ratification would be achieved by the people, quote, not as individuals composing one entire nation, but as composing the distinct and independent states to which they respectively belong. After Jefferson was elected, the New England Federalists attempted to secede for about 10 or 12 years, and they held a secession convention in Hartford, Connecticut. They voted not to secede, but the leader of this was Timothy Pickering, who was George Washington's Secretary of State and Secretary of War, and he said that secession was the principle of the American Revolution to justify this New England secession movement. There's a book called, by William Wright, called The Secession Movement in the Middle Atlantic States, where he writes about a vigorous secession movement there prior to the war, where people there believed there was a right of secession. But Lincoln had to deny this, that there was a right of secession. And I quote the legal scholar James Ostrowski, who I think put together a summary of what Lincoln's interpretation of the Constitution on this topic has to say. And it's sort of a mind game. He says, well, this is what the founders had to have believed in when they were ratifying the Constitution in order to take Lincoln's position. One, no state may ever secede for any reason. Two, if a state does secede, the federal government may suppress the secession with military force. Three, the federal government may coerce all states to provide militias to suppress the seceding state. Four, after suppressing the seceded state, the federal government may govern that state with a military dictatorship until the state accepts the supremacy of the federal government. Five, after the suppression, the federal government may force the state to adopt a new constitution imposed on it by military force, which happened in Reconstruction. Six, the president may unilaterally suspend the Bill of Rights and the writ of habeas corpus. If they believe, and it's unlikely that if they believe those things, the Constitution would ever pass. It was barely passed to begin with. And I've read these books. You know, if you read Constitutional Problems Under Lincoln by James Randall, Freedom Under Lincoln by Dean Sprague, Fate of Liberty by Mark Neely, Constitutional Dictatorship by Clinton Rossiter, you have Clinton Rossiter saying, Clinton's amazing disregard for the Constitution was considered by nobody as legal. James Ford Rhodes, in his History of the United States, said, never had the power of a dictator fallen into safer and nobler hands. James Randall, again, in Constitutional Problems Under Lincoln, said, if Lincoln was a dictator, it must be admitted that he was a benevolent dictator. Now, why are these scholars all calling Lincoln a dictator? Well, he launched a military invasion without consent of Congress. He suspended habeas corpus, and which ended up at least 13,000 northern citizens imprisoned without being arrested, without a warrant being issued. There was a prison in New York Harbor that became known as the American Bastille, Fort Lafayette, censored all telegraph communication, nationalized railroads, ordered federal troops to interfere with northern elections. David Donald writes that the Republican Party won New York State by 7,000 votes in 1864, quote, with the help of federal bayonets, end quote. Deported Ohio Congressman Clement Vallandigham for disagreeing with him. Confiscated firearms. Ministers in the South were imprisoned for not praying for Abraham Lincoln. William Seward set up a secret police force, and he famously boasted to Lord Lyons, the British ambassador, that he could ring a bell and have any man in America arrested. The Journal of Commerce, early in the Lincoln administration, published a list of 100 newspapers in opposition to Lincoln administration, and Lincoln ordered the Postmaster General to stop delivering the mail for those papers. Some of them ordered hired paper boys, but then they put an end to that too. And so a lot of these newspaper owners and editors were imprisoned at this time. That's why that was apparently necessary to stop the secession. He also, James McPherson, writes in, I think it's his book, Abraham Lincoln and the Second American Revolution, of what a micromanager Lincoln was of the war effort. And he spent 11 days in the field with the Army of the Potomac. McPherson says he spent more time in the War Department telegraph office than anywhere else except the White House itself. Stephen Oates says pretty much the same thing, that he was very hands-on, and that he knew all about what Sherman was up to and what Sheridan was up to. I don't have much time left, but in the interest of saving time, I argue in my book that there were incidents of waging war on civilians at the very beginning, 1862, 1863. The town of Randolph, Tennessee, was burned to the ground because Confederate sharpshooters were shooting at Union ships. and they couldn't find the sharpshooters, so they retaliated by burning the town. And this sort of thing went on the whole time. And so in one of the latter chapters of my book called The Great Centralizer, I write about how all of these economic things were achieved in the first 18 months of the Lincoln administration. The tariff was essentially tripled and remained that high for decades after the war ended. The internal improvements, Leonard Curry in his book Blueprint for Modern Society says that there were, quote, no more constitutional scruples. That is, for 70 years there were constitutional arguments against corporate welfare. No more. This was gone. Nationalized money supply at last. Senator John Sherman again, when they, as a result of the National Currency Acts and the Legal Tender Acts, he said this, these will nationalize as much as possible, even the currency, so as to make men love their country before their states. All private interests, all local interests, all banking interests, the interests of individuals, everything should be subordinate now to the interests of the government, end quote. Senator John Sherman. The New York Times editorialized on March 9, 1863 that, quote, the Legal Tender Act and the National Currency Bill crystallized a centralization of power such as Hamilton might have eulogized as magnificent, end quote. And that, how much time do I have, David?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. You turn that on? I think in the front.
Oh, yeah.
I think in the front. Yeah. No, this side. Yeah. Upside down. And one question I ask you, in terms of the cost of the war, 620,000 deaths in a population of 30 million people, if you standardize that for today's population of roughly 280 million, that would be the equivalent of about 5.5 million deaths, or 100 times the number of Americans who died in Vietnam. And I look at that, and that's absolutely horrible. No one would disagree with that. And in the book Time on the Cross by Fogel and Engerman, they do a survey of emancipation in this time period. And they find that dozens of countries, including the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, the French and Danish colonies, dozens of countries ended slavery peacefully through some sort of compensated emancipation. Now, of course, the standard argument is that this could never have happened here. We could have never have done this. But I don't see any reason to believe why British slave owners valued their slaves any less than American slave owners did. They didn't want this. The British government paid them off 40 cents on the dollar. It might not have been possible in 1861, but I think in terms of the sheer amount of the death and the total destruction of the economy of the country, North and South, the North took a huge economic hit as well as the South because of all of this anarchic trade. The one big quandary is why didn't we do what every other country in the world did during the previous 50 years that ended slavery and ended peacefully through compensated emancipation. Final thing I'll say is that some of the great classical liberals, or Lockean liberals, if you will, at the time, were not on Lincoln's side. Lord Acton wrote a letter to Robert E. Lee on November 4, 1866, and said this, I saw in states' rights the only availing check upon the absolutism of the sovereign will, and secession filled me with hope not as a destruction, but as a redemption of democracy. I deem that you were fighting the battles of our liberty, our progress, and our civilization, and I mourn for the stake which was lost at Richmond more deeply than I rejoice over that which was saved at Waterloo. And the famous abolitionist Lysander Spooner, who was quite famous in Massachusetts because he wrote a book on jury nullification, a guide for lawyers in New England to how to go about getting juries to nullify jury verdicts that would send slaves back to the South. And he was a big hero among the Massachusetts abolitionists. But by 1870, after he had observed what had happened, he said this, all these cries of having abolished slavery, of having saved the country, of having preserved the Union, of establishing a government of consent, and of maintaining the national honor are all gross, shameless, transparent cheats, so transparent that they ought to deceive no one, end quote. And this is a prominent abolitionist saying this. And the final thing I'll say is General Don Piatt, who was a friend of Lincoln's, made a very interesting comment to me. He was a newspaper editor after the war, and he said that the way in which the Republican Party used the former slaves as political pawns in the South so poisoned late race relations in the South that they may never recover from that. And Tocqueville actually noticed in Democracy in America that he said that he thought race relations were actually worse in the states that had eliminated slavery as of the early 1830s than in the South. Whether that's just one man's observation, but I think that's one of the costs of the war, the poisoning of race relations, and I think African Americans would have achieved, as Jeff Hummel has said, no, it's not Jeff Hummel, Doug Banda, sorry Jeff, I don't want to bring you in on this, that they would have received justice as well as freedom sooner, much sooner, had we done what England did and all the other countries of the world. Time is up.